Welcome to Peoria on Faith, a special presentation of Peoria Public Radio. I'm Rabbi Daniel Bogard. Today we're talking about multiculturalism, really a faith unto itself. A faith that the world is a better place when our neighborhoods are filled with different cultures, different foods, and different beliefs. My guest for this segment is Imam Kamil Mufti, the spiritual leader of the Islamic Foundation of Peoria. Imam Mufti, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Daniel.
Now, I think many of us probably aren't very familiar with the Muslim community here in Peoria. Could you just give us an overview of what organizations exist here? Who are the people here?
Sure. We originally have the Islamic Center of Peoria, which has been around for a while. Imam Abdullah Lansari is the spiritual leader over there. We have the Islamic Foundation of Peoria. That is the organization I'm connected with. It was built to serve the needs of the growing community of Muslims in Dunlap and surrounding areas. Then we have the Darul Uloom full-time Islamic school that used to operate out of the Islamic Foundation of Peoria and is now located in the Charter Oak facility where the Islamic Center of Peoria is located. But they are an independent organization. We also have the Mecca Center, which is affiliated with the Imam W.D. Muhammad, predominantly African-American community. They have been here perhaps the oldest. They hold their meetings on Sundays. They are located on Armstrong Avenue. And lastly, we have the MSA House for the Muslim students going to Bradley in order for them to break their fast in Ramadan and to offer their regular prayers and for fellowship and other stuff.
So you've got the two main mosques, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And what's the difference between these organizations? Why would someone join one organization versus another? Is it just where they live?
It's pretty much just where they live. There is no concept of, one mosque being a home to some people as opposed to being the other mosque being a home to some other people. And I'll give you an example. The Friday prayers, we have people who would pray their other prayers or go for their community dinners and socialization and other activities to the other mosque. But for Friday prayers, which are, similar to the Jewish Friday night services, I would say, and the Christian Sunday services, these people will come, for instance, to our mosque. And people who will typically be even on the board of the Islamic Foundation of Peoria will pray in the Islamic Center of Peoria and vice versa. So, people will switch. So it's simply a matter of geography.
So you also mentioned that there's a school here for the kids.
Yes.
How big is that school?
I'm not sure what is their latest numbers of student population, but it is definitely over 100 students. It's at this point, I believe it's at 8th grade. But they are going to add further grades going all the way to high school.
Wonderful. And so the kids who go to this school, is their education a broad education as well? It's not just Islamic studies. They get math and science and civics and...
Well, I'm not sure if they have civics. But they have everything else according to the state requirements. Science, math, reading, writing, everything else. I think the only thing different is they have some religious studies on maybe a couple of days. I'm not sure exactly how many, maybe 2 or 3 days, like one class. And it is to teach them the Arabic alphabet, the ability for them to read and recite the Quran, which is the Muslim holy scripture. That's about it. But the rest of it, the bulk of it, is it's just like any other school, any other private parochial school.
Hmm. So moving on a little bit, the Muslim community here in Peoria, how big is it? Do you have any feel?
Well, it's hard to estimate. I would say a conservative guesstimate would be over 1,000 people, basing it on the attendance of the major holidays. So basing it on, the kids, we have quite a few kids going in the Peoria, Washington, and the Dunlap school districts, and the adults, both men and women, I would say it would be over 1,000 easily.
So what you're saying is the Muslim community is just like all other religious communities, and we see 85% of our people only once a year, twice a year? Okay. So what brings Muslims to Peoria? Where are they coming from?
Well, that's a good question. Let me start off by saying that some of them were born in Peoria and they have lived here their entire lives. The principal of our Sunday school is one example. I know of many people who went to Peoria or Dunlap school districts. They went on to Bradley and they have settled in or around Peoria and they've never left Peoria. Then we have many people who came to Peoria 30 or 40 years ago, and they are now living in Peoria in retirement. Caterpillar, OSF, Methodist, and Proctor, of course, these are the main hiring companies. They seem to attract the most people. But there are some small business owners who are here either because of relatives, family members, or different reasons.
So you have congregants, you have members of these organizations who were born in Peoria, who maybe are second, third, fourth, fifth generation Muslims in the United States, and you have people who are literally fresh off the boat. Is that?
Yes, I would say there are people who have come here literally a few months ago or a year ago, and they are finishing their master's in Bradley. And then they get hired because Bradley has a program with Caterpillar. They will get hired in Caterpillar. So you have quite a few people like this who are starting off. You know, they are not married. And then once they graduate, they join Caterpillar. They get married. They start a family. So we have people like this. And then we do have up to third generation Muslims native to Peoria. Yep.
So I imagine that's rather difficult. You know, I know when I think of the Muslim community, in my head at least, I think of it sometimes as being rather homogenous. But really, the Muslim community here in Peoria has such diversity. You have people who were born here generations ago. You have people who have moved here from all sorts of different countries, I imagine. Yes, North Africa and the Arab world and Europe and everywhere we could imagine. That must be quite the challenge for you as their spiritual leader to create some sort of community with such diversity.
Well, I, you know, kind of trying to figure out and nail down the countries from where I do know people come from. We have Canadian Muslims. We have Muslims from China, Nigeria, Sudan, Bangladesh, Pakistan, India, Cambodia, Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Yemen, Bosnia, Albania, and Turkey. Not to mention the natives, Black Americans, and of course some Caucasian white Americans as well.
So I think you're reinforcing my question. How do you create a community? I mean, that's the real challenge, really, of multiculturalism in general, right?
Sure.
How do we enlarge as a society,
yep,
create community?
Well, just like being American means, for instance, democracy, freedom, and equality. These are the core values of being American. The core Christian values, at least from what some of my Christian friends have told me, would be love, hope, and grace. For Reformed Jews, it would be fixing what is broken. Similarly, there are some fundamental Muslim values. The very word Islam itself has the connotation of peace. I know it's hard to believe these days, but that's really where the word, the root of the word comes from. And this peace is attained in one's life, in its inner peace as well as outer peace, by worshiping God alone and upholding beliefs in the six articles of faith, which is belief in one true God, belief in angels, belief in the scriptures revealed by God, the prophets of God, the day of judgment, and predestiny, as well as the five pillars of practice: the declaration of faith, prayer, charitable giving, fasting, the month of Ramadan, and the annual pilgrimage for those who are able to perform. They form the core of Islam and provide the foundation on which a diverse group such as ours can connect. And I've read several studies which actually said that the Muslims in North America are perhaps the most diverse group of all groups that exist in continental North America. But it is these, you know, certain core beliefs and certain core practices which give, you know, a unifying foundation for people to come around.
So with all of this diversity, all of these congregants from so many different places, that has to be quite the challenge to create one spiritual community.
Yes, it is. It is a challenge. But, you know, there are matters, as I said, the core. And then there are those matters, you know, where we agree to disagree. They are either based on a difference in interpretation of texts or forms of worship, as well as the cultural experiences of different groups.
And what do you see as some of the different needs of these two groups, Muslims born in America and Muslims who have immigrated here?
Well, obviously, you know, people who will come from a foreign culture or people who will come from, you know, outside of the United States, they will have different cultural expectations. I think culture would always be different. Food is a big thing. Dress differences. There might be some differences in dress.
You're listening to Peoria on Faith here on Peoria Public Radio. So changing topics a little bit, one of the unfortunate side effects of the war on terror, as well as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, at least in my perception, is that anti-Islamic sentiments have grown pretty rapidly in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a recent study done by University of North Carolina professor Christopher Bale, he found an exponential increase in anti-Islamic leanings over the last 15 years How has this influenced you? How does this influence your community? Do you encounter these sorts of sentiments regularly?
Well, indeed. First thing to realize is that Islamophobia is real. And it has been studied by different think tanks and by different experts who have written on the subject. And it is something which is very well documented. One of the premier think tanks from Britain has actually identified 8 different criteria of Islamophobia, one of which is Islam is seen as a monolithic block, static and unresponsive to change. And that's perhaps, you know, one of the things which is very untrue. There is about 8 different criteria which they have. Islam is seen as separate and other, in the sense that it does not have values in common with other cultures. It's not affected by them, does not influence them. It is seen as violent or aggressive, threatening. There is a clash of civilizations. So all these things, you know, the rhetoric is out there. The fear and the mistrust, which I would say is based mostly on lack of exposure and lack of knowledge, is there. And it's perhaps strengthened with media images and stereotypes, as you've pointed out. So realizing this, we decided to do something about it. I personally, as well as my congregation, one of the things which we did was host an open house last year in summer, 1 week before Ramadan. This was again last year in summer. We had excellent attendance from the legal political community from Peoria all the way to Springfield, as well as faith communities from within Peoria and all the way from Eureka. Our open doors are open. Peoria Academy comes every year for a visit. Their teachers bring the group of kids every year, wonderful kids. They come every year. At Bradley, the OLI classes that yourself and I and Pastor Jim a part of. This is also an ongoing part of the interfaith dialogue in order to shed misconceptions, to address questions, and to be more open. Also, we have some other OLI classes that are coming to our facilities, asking questions and trying to learn more and you know, have a shared experience.
Now, have you yourself or members of your community faced anti-Islamic sentiments or actions here in Peoria?
Those things are part of life. They're part of life. I guess I've been here long enough to kind of accept them as part of life. And sometimes the kids are exposed to that. And many times it is not open, but it's more of a feeling which is there. And I think with more dialogue and with more openness, I'm a very big proponent of dialogue. I think with more dialogue and more openness, I think those issues can be addressed. But yes, there have been incidents where, for instance, somebody would make fun of a lady dressed in hijab. So we have had, you know, incidents like this. But once again, as I said, I am a proponent of education and open dialogue, and I think that can remove a lot of these misconceptions. When people get to know Muslims at a personal level, I think it can do miracles.
Now, we're talking multiculturalism today, mm-hmm. and one of the narratives that we hear all too frequently is that Islam is a religion that really, because of its foundational beliefs, cannot coexist with other religions. Mm-hmm. Essentially, this is a view that says Islam is incompatible with multiculturalism. How would you respond to someone who asked that question?
Well, again, without going into too much details, because, you know, what does multiculturalism mean? I'd just like to mention a few things. One would be a key verse from the Muslim Holy Scripture, from Surah Al-Ma'idah, which means a table which is set out for people to eat from. The second verse, which states in translation, that assist one another, work with one another in matters of piety and righteousness, in matters of common good, and do not assist one another in matters of sin and transgression. So this verse forms the basis of coexistence and multiculturalism from a Muslim perspective. Now, coming back more directly to the question which you asked, I have several points which I would like to make regarding that. One, this is contrary to the vision of the founding fathers of our country. For instance, there were thousands of Muslims in the United States in 1776 who were imported as slaves from Africa, where Islam flourished, and it still flourishes till this day. So the founding fathers had contact with Muslims, and we have actually some academic texts written about Islam and the slave experience of the Muslim slaves from that time period. Campaigning for religious freedom in Virginia, Jefferson, in demanding recognition of the religious rights of the Muslims, the Jews, and he also included the pagans. Supporting Jefferson was his old friend, Richard Henry Lee. True freedom, he said, embraces the Muslims and the Gentoo. He called the Muslims Mahometan, and he called the Hindus Gentoo. Second, if we look at history outside of the continental United States, outside of the founding forefathers, we have a long history of coexistence between Muslims and non-Muslims. In Mughal India, the Mughals, when they ruled the India, the Hindus survived. They prospered and they eventually took over. In Umayyad Spain, Al-Andalusia, Muslims, Jews, and Christians, they lived happily in the most modern state in all of Europe at that time. You're very well aware of that. In Egypt and Syria, a significant minority of the country is still Christian, despite living under Muslim rule for 1400 years. Contrary to some perceived notions that exist today, Muslims have always been tolerant of non-Muslim minorities or majorities in lands. They were more tolerant on the giving end than they have been on the receiving end. Had Islam been as intolerant as other ideologies, the non-Muslim countries in the Muslim world would have disappeared like the Moors of Spain did. Third, Muslims actually preserved the wisdom of earlier civilizations. The oldest universities in the world are in Muslim lands. Everything from the philosophy of the ancient Greeks, the numerical system of ancient India, and the agricultural marvels of ancient Persia, they were all preserved instead of destroyed by the Muslims.
So, a couple questions for you.
Sure.
We asked on Facebook for questions. And if you'd like to join the conversation in the future, make sure to like Peoria Public Radio on Facebook. So anyways, Jim in Peoria asks, should Sharia law be applied to non-Muslims? And I guess first, quickly, what do we mean when we say Sharia law? What is that?
Without going into much detail, because I think this would really require a separate session where we can perhaps talk about some of the misconceptions regarding what is Sharia law, because there is a lot of talk regarding this issue. I would right now, just make a comparison between the canon law for the Catholics and the halakha for the Jews. That's analogous. That would be an analogy, except that Sharia also incorporates manners and models. It incorporates ethics as well as the belief system. So it is in some ways very analogous to the word Islam itself, and that incorporates the rituals, acts of worship, and everything else, financial matters, so on and so forth.
So Sharia law is for Muslims in the same way that Catholics have canon law, in the same way that canon law doesn't apply to me as a Jew.
The Sharia law does not apply to anybody living in the United States who is a Jew, non-Jew, or anybody else. No. And a Muslim, even when they are alive or dead, Sharia applies to them in the sense that how they are buried, just like how the Jews are buried, or the food which they eat, just like the food which Jews eat, or some dietary restrictions which are followed by people of other faith. It's very similar.
Finally, we have another question from Facebook from Dan in East Peoria. And he wonders, sometimes we see these images on TV that portray Islam as a whole in rather an extreme light, in a fanatical light. Mm-hmm. He wants to know, how can we find a way to not make assumptions about the entirety of the Muslim community based on these images we see?
Well, get to know a Muslim. That's what one of my pastor friends suggested, and I wholeheartedly agree with him. Get to know a Muslim, get to find out about their culture, about their beliefs, and get to know them at a personal and a human level. I was actually reading a study done by some experts in which they said that instead of talking about multiculturalism, we should talk about omniculturalism, which is give people as individuals their human dignity first, respect them as human beings first, before you start categorizing them and thinking of them in terms of groups. I really agree with that. I think that's a very good thing. Again, there is only so much you can learn from sound bites and news clips. There is nothing like actually meeting real people and getting to know them and see if you think that they are, see how you like them.
Well, I can say, speaking for myself, having gotten to know you and growing our friendship really has opened my eyes to the Muslim world broadly and here in Peoria. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Imam Kamil Mufti of the Islamic Foundation of Peoria about multiculturalism and Peoria's Muslim community. For Peoria Public Radio, I'm Rabbi Daniel Bogard, and this is Peoria on Faith. This is Peoria on Faith, a production of 89.9 Peoria Public Radio. I'm Rabbi Daniel Bogard. In today's show, we're speaking about multiculturalism, what President Carter called not a melting pot, but a beautiful mosaic. For this segment, we're talking to Katie Crenshaw of the Baha'i Center of Peoria about her faith, about her community, and about the multiculturalism that's built into the very soul of the Baha'i religion. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know when we first spoke and when I first started looking into the tenets of the Baha'i faith, I was amazed at the universalism that seems to be at the center of this faith. Am I correct that for Baha'is, Moses and Jesus and Muhammad, the Buddha and Krishna are all considered prophets?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, Baha'is are followers of Baha'u'llah, who they believe is a messenger of God that was foretold in these religions of the past. And that all of these messengers of God are sent to humanity throughout time. And they do include Abraham, Krishna, Moses, Buddha, Zoroaster, Christ, Muhammad. And that they all essentially tell a story from God that is united.
So you see all of these prophets as really telling one story. Is that correct? What's the message that you see that unites all of these different prophets, all these different faiths?
Well, it could be said that throughout time, God sends his messengers to relay certain principles that are universal throughout all the religions of God. In fact, it's easy to see how all of these religions we've mentioned talk about brotherhood, love, justice, these kind of things that are essential parts of the human soul that ultimately the purpose of these religions is to bring out of us. And then also that each religion comes with a special teaching for the time in which they came. So perhaps you could even think about humanity as a child going to school, and that in first grade, the teacher has a certain book from which the student learns. But then once that child reaches, for example, fifth grade, those teachings from the first book haven't become irrelevant, but rather that, you know, as the child progresses, then so does the teachings.
So the most recent prophet, the most recent teacher that the Baha'i revere, Baha'u'llah, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about him.
Well, Baha'u'llah was a Persian nobleman in 1800s who essentially gave up his life of what could have been power to instead take care of the poor in his midst, and also to bring teachings that he claimed were from God that would usher in a promised day of peace. And the essential message of Baha'u'llah's teachings is one of unity. So, for example, there's one God, that there's one human race, and that all the world's religions represent stages in the revelation of God's will and purpose for humanity.
So tell me about Baha'i today. How large is Baha'i? How many adherents are there? Where do we find Baha'i other than here in Peoria?
Well, there are Baha'is in every country of the world. And although it is a relatively small community, It can be found in different cultures and different statuses of society in every part of the globe.
So how do followers of Baha'i practice their religion? What are some of the observances that you do as a member of the Baha'i?
That's a good question. I think perhaps what we could say is that there are two ways in which Baha'is practice their faith. One is to contribute to their own personal growth and development, and the second is to contribute collectively to the betterment of society.
So what does that look like in practice, where rubber meets the road? What do you do as a member of the Baha'i?
Perhaps on a personal level, some of the most significant things include prayer, reading of the Baha'i writings, and trying to put those teachings essentially of compassion and justice, humility, these kinds of qualities that are actually found in all the sacred scriptures into practice, also fasting. And then on a more global level, Baha'is are actively working in communities and as individuals to put some of the fundamental principles of the Baha'i faith into action. And those may include the elimination of all forms of prejudice, equality between men and women, the recognition of the essential oneness of the world's great religions, also universal education, the harmony of science and religion, sustainable balance between nature and technology, the establishment of a world federal system based on collective security and the oneness of humanity.
Now, on a personal level, you just finished, I believe, a 19-day fast. Is that correct?
Exactly.
So tell us about that. How does this fast work, and what was it about?
Personally, it's my favorite time of the year.
Okay. We have different views on fasting then.
Actually, fasting is, as you may know, part of the tradition of most of the world's great religions. That serves a spiritual purpose as a reminder to let go of our own kind of selfish desires and to instead focus our energy on giving and focus our energy on developing good and helpful qualities.
Beautiful. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Peoria on Faith here on Peoria Public Radio. Today we're exploring the multicultural world of Peoria's faith communities. In this segment, we're talking to Katie Crenshaw, a representative of the Peoria Baha'i Faith, about her beliefs, her community, and the multiculturalism that's woven into the very fabric of the Baha'i. Now, I lived for a while in Israel, and one of the things I was always amazed by was in Haifa in the north. There are the most beautiful gardens that I have ever seen, the Baha'i gardens. And I knew nothing about their purpose other than that they were beautiful, and I used to love to walk through them. What is that about? What's the Baha'i connection to Israel, and why these gardens?
Many people, I think, have seen these gardens and wondered the same things. Well, Israel has particular significance in the Baha'i faith because of historical circumstance. Baha'u'llah, he was exiled and sent from place to place as his teachings spread. And eventually he was banished to Israel. And it is there that he decreed that his world center, the world center of the Baha'i faith, would be, and that this would serve as a central place of focus for the Baha'i community so that unity can be established and maintained. So in Haifa, you'll find these gardens and also holy places for the Baha'is. The founder of the Baha'i faith, Baha'u'llah, is buried there in Israel, and also his forerunner, the Bab, which is the name that means the gate. So these holy places are very special to the Baha'is, and because of their spiritual significance, the gardens serve as a source of peacefulness and add to the beauty of these sanctified spaces.
So talking about the local Peoria community, I know for a lot of us, we've driven on university and seen the Baha'i Center there. Who are the local Peoria Baha'is? What do you do with this community?
I can't tell you how many times people have said, I've seen your Baha'i Center, but I know nothing about your religion. The Peoria Baha'i community essentially is working towards some very universal goals of the Baha'i faith. And although our community is very small, about 50 or so Baha'is in the Peoria area, still we're trying to make strides in collaboration with others in the community towards what is the essential teaching of the Baha'i faith, that the earth is but one country and mankind its citizens, that we are the leaves of one branch and the fruits of one tree. So perhaps some of the more concrete things that the Baha'is in Peoria are doing would include gatherings for people of all different backgrounds or religions to pray together. And then in connection with that, in the spirit of coming together from any kinds of faith or backgrounds, there are classes for children that teach moral education, and also some small groups at neighborhood levels that help to give young teens a space where they can use their energies to benefit society.
So I know for many people who come from a church background, you know, you think of Sunday mornings or in the Jewish community, Friday nights. Do you gather weekly in this space? And if so, what does that look like?
There are gatherings at that Baha'i Center on Sunday mornings. Also, in the Baha'i faith, there's something called the 19-day feast. The Baha'i calendar is comprised of 19 months of 19 days. So on the first day of that month, then Baha'is come together for what is not a physical feast of eating food, but what is more of a spiritual time to get together as a community, both for social and administrative purposes.
So if I walked into one of these meetings, or if I walked into the feast, first of all, would I be welcome?
You would be most welcome.
And what would I encounter? Take me through what it would look like.
I think something that characterizes most Baha'i gatherings is prayer. So turning to God together to supplicate his assistance and to praise him.
And do you turn, you said you turn in prayer. Do you literally turn towards a direction?
No. Perhaps one can think of God being like the sun and ourselves being like a mirror. And so to turn ourselves towards God is to assist us in reflecting his light and attributes. Hmm.
So how do you become a member of the Baha'i? Were you born as a member of the Baha'i?
My parents are Baha'is. So I would say, yes, I was born into a Baha'i family. Although in the Baha'i faith, independent investigation of the truth is one of the central tenets. And so each Baha'i must choose for himself that he or she should follow the teachings of Baha'u'llah.
Interesting. And what about your parents? Were they born into the Baha'i faith?
Well, my mom became a Baha'i when she was in college, and my dad's parents also became Baha'is when he was a child.
Okay. Okay. I guess with a religion that began in the 1800s, you have many, many conversion stories like that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. We've been speaking with Katie Crenshaw of Peoria's Baha'i community about her faith, about her community, and about the multiculturalism within the Baha'i faith that allows it to acknowledge the prophets held dear by so many other faiths, from Krishna to Jesus, Muhammad to Buddha, as well as the Jewish prophets. I'm Rabbi Daniel Bogard, and you're listening to Peoria on Faith, a production of 89.9 Peoria Public Radio. Katie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Peoria on Faith, a production of Peoria Public Radio. I'm Rabbi Daniel Bogard. In today's show, we've been talking about multiculturalism and the beautiful diversity within Peoria's faith communities. For this segment, we're speaking with Sister Rachel, the pastoral associate of St. Thomas in Peoria Heights, and Veronica Barzalo, a local Catholic from Ecuador. We're speaking with them about the different perspectives and faith experiences that Catholics bring from the various countries that they come from in this world. So we're going to be talking about your different experiences in the Catholic Church with different ethnic backgrounds. So, Veronica, I thought we'd start with you, if that's okay.
All right.
You grew up as a devout Catholic in Ecuador. What was your experience entering into a church in the United States for the first time? How different was it?
Well, it was really hard when we just came to the U.S. Everything was new for us, the language, the culture. So it was nice to go to a church and find something similar there. You know, maybe the rituals a little bit different, but the essence to find God in that place, to find peace in that place, was amazing.
And Sister Rachel, you work as a clergy member in these churches. Do you see that experience much with people coming from their home countries, entering into the church? How hard is it for them to adjust?
I do see several different ethnic groups as we have in our parish. I would say that it is really probably in part helpful that they have their own community. Like, for example, we have a community of Vietnamese families, and they're very strongly connected to one another in their family units. And so that's very supportive to them in the context of the whole church, where they can feel more comfortable because they have people they know there who are of like mind and like experience. I think when families come who are really not as connected to their own families of origin and ethnically, I think it's more difficult for them to fit into, because it's not, it's, as Veronica said, it certainly is a universality of the church and the experience of the worship to a certain extent. And that's one of the beauties, I think, of the Catholic Church, that we are a universal church. So no matter where we are in the world, we have the same experience of worship in its essence. However, that takes on a different flavor, obviously, within the cultures, again, which I think is one of the gifts of the church, that we have different cultural experiences within that larger picture. But it does matter, I believe, in the kind of support they have that, in a certain sense, they bring with them or they connect with them within the community.
Sure, sure. So, Sister Rachel, you described the different flavors that Catholics bring from these different countries. I like that expression. So, Veronica, what do you see as the different flavor that you bring from Ecuador? What was different about the experience in the Ecuadorian church as opposed to here in Peoria?
Well, we would have to go to the kind of the beginning of the Catholicism in South America, when pioneers and came to conquer the New World. They brought the Catholic faith, but it was mixed with all the beliefs that the people already there had, the natives. They have already their rituals, their, you know, gods, and then so everything came together with a unique way of expressing, you know, this new religion that they had. So I think it's very unique, because you have certain rituals and expressions and a very not different way to express your faith, but a unique, a more personal, more spontaneous. So I don't know if I saw a difference here, because you follow kind of the same order in a mass, and I am not part of a just speaking Spanish community here. I try to blend with the American people and try to be part of that. So I don't see really a difference when I go to church, but still, you know, you can tell when somebody is Hispanic or from, you know, from Latin America.
So for those of us who haven't been to Ecuador and maybe never will, can you give us an example of one of these rituals, one of these things that happen there?
We have different celebrations, around the time in the church. For example, in Christmas time, we will do a novena, which is prayers that you do for 9 days before Jesus. We celebrate the birthday of Jesus. So little details like that. We are strong. We have the Virgin Mary is a very important part of our faith. Saints are a very important part of our faith. It won't be strange to find in every house an image of Jesus or of the Last Supper in your dining room. For us, Easter is very important, but we don't celebrate Easter as much as we celebrate the Holy Week. So little details like that, but itself in the Mass, I would say that things are similar.
So Sister Rachel, working as a clergy member here, what do you see? What different needs exist in the different communities, in the different Catholic communities here, depending on their cultural and ethnic background?
I would say, and it's interesting you said that, Veronica, that you think it's a lot the same here, because my sense is that the experience of people who are from, I want to say, more Latin American countries, I think there's more spontaneity. There's more what I would call embodiment. You're more engaged with a particular ceremony, even like the songs and the you have more, like, I want to call it dancing, that sort of ritual. Processions maybe is a better word for you in your culture. But it seems to me that you're more involved in sort of an embodied way than we are as Western European people. We're less engaged bodily and emotionally in the service.
I think it can vary too much from one country to another. So it will be different. Maybe the way of, you know, Mexicans will be, you know, expressing their faith than Ecuadorians. It could be so different. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that we are more sensitive. We are more spontaneous. Maybe not as formal. You know, you make lines in order to get to communion. You have to follow, you know, the people in front of you. In Ecuador, no. You can go anytime you want. You know, simple things like that.
So you both spoke about the differences that you see in what, Sister Rachel, you called the sort of Western European background Catholics and Catholics that come from Spanish-speaking countries, Latino Catholics. How much is this starting to blend? You know, we see this growth of Latino Catholics. Is that starting to influence the rest of the church in the United States? Is it influencing you here in Peoria?
Well, I think there's two answers to that question. I think there is probably more of an influence in areas where there's a higher percentage of Hispanics. I believe that they are very family-oriented, and so they're very kind of close-knit. And so they stay within themselves, I think, in their own worship, rather than blend with the larger community as much. Hmm. And maybe that's because we haven't met their needs as much. I don't know.
I think there are two parts, again, of that. I think, in one hand, we have to think that in our countries, the family is the most important unit, the social unit, most important. So, you know, when you come as an immigrant, maybe you try to find something similar to what you have in your country. So you try to get connected with people who speak the same language, who has the same culture, and try to agroup with them. And I think it's nice that some churches welcome these people and even create a mass in their own language in order to serve them better. I think that's really nice. But at the same time, yeah, I agree. Maybe they are not blending with the rest of the Catholic community. In the other hand, you have, like my experience, I came and I am not part of a specific group. I am part of this community. And I have, I think I have sensed this difference from Ecuador. Like in Ecuador, since family is so important, you don't need to be part of a parish, of a community. Here, the community, the church family is very, very important. So they become your family and you're part of them. And, you know, you do service, you help them. And it was so nice for me when we I was pregnant for the first time, and oh my gosh, they organize serving foods for me. You know, we don't do that in Ecuador. You don't need to do that because you have so much family around you. It's all solved. Here you are alone and you will find this kind of service. So I think you live in a community, even though they don't speak the same language in my case.
That's beautiful. Now, Veronica, you said that you've chosen really to take part in the English-speaking communities rather than the Spanish-speaking church communities here. There are church services in Spanish, that's correct?
At the cathedral.
At the cathedral. What's that about for you?
I think that as an immigrant, you come to a different country. It's fair to try to adjust to the place you're coming to. I think it's a challenge to learn the language, to learn how to pray in a different language. But I think it's fair to do it, too, because my kids are American, and I want to be connected with them, too. I think it's important to keep my customs, my language, that they speak Spanish very well. But at the same time, I think it's important to be part of a community.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Peoria on Faith here on Peoria Public Radio. Today we're exploring the multicultural world of Peoria's faith communities. In this segment, we're talking to Sister Rachel and Veronica Barzalo about the ethnic diversity of the Catholic Church and how it impacts faith experiences. So we have a new pope, and we have a pope from Latin America, Pope Francis from Argentina. Though Ecuador and Argentina are 2,600 miles apart, what does it mean to you, Veronica, to have a pope who comes from South America?
Well, it's amazing. I cannot describe the happiness that this brings to us. I think it's a person who not only speaks your language, that it will be wonderful to have someone who will probably visit in your country and speak the same language. But also, he knows exactly what's going on in Latin America and what are the needs. He is so dedicated to the poor, and he is teaching us so many lessons about being part of this Catholic world, but as servants, serving the people who is around you. So it's just a different perspective of seeing things. We are very excited about
Sister Rachel, what changes do you imagine Pope Francis will bring to the church, bring from his South American background?
I believe that from what I have seen, that Pope Francis is a person who is, from a descriptive word for me, would be authentic. I think he's a very authentic, humble, real person. And I think his ties with a world that knows a lot of difference in terms of poverty and those kinds of social justice needs are going to really play well in terms of a lot of the people in the Catholic Church. I think they appreciate that. From what I have heard from people, they're very excited about the way he has presented himself, his ability to relate to people, his spontaneity. Those are the kind of qualities that really speak well of a leader, and I think lots of people are very excited about that.
So do you think we're going to see a Catholic Church that's engaging more and more with issues of poverty, issues of social justice?
I can only say what I've seen, but my sense is that he's probably going to bring to the fore our need to be a church that's serving all people. The church has taught for a long time the preferential option to the poor, and I think that's really a commitment that he has.
So when we look more broadly at world Catholicism, 31% of all Catholics in the world live in either South or Central America. Only 16% live in North America, and that, of course, includes Mexico. And when we look at these demographics, Catholicism and religious orientation in general are shrinking in the United States and just exploding in Latin America. What change do you think this is going to bring to the Catholic Church in our lifetime and in the lifetime of our children and grandchildren?
Well, I think one of the most important things in the Latin American people is that we are more concentrated in humans more than in material things. So if you see things in that perspective, you know, in serving people, in fight about poverty, I think, you know, you have a different perspective of everything. So I don't know. I hope it keeps increasing the number of Catholics in other countries too.
I think the United States, because of the excitement that we see with the people in North America, in the United States in particular, they're somehow relating to him, although they're not, you know, from that ethnic background. I think there's a relationship because they do appreciate what he stands for, where he comes, how he relates to people. So that kind of can fire, I think, a bit of enthusiasm that hopefully he's bringing in the name of the people of Latin America in terms of what you're just talking about.
Now, what lessons do you think Catholics in the United States from Western European backgrounds, what lessons can we learn from Catholics who are coming from Mexico, from Ecuador, from Argentina? What gifts can they bring to our community?
I think they can bring, for one, a faith that is very family-oriented. I think would really enhance family. I think also the spontaneity of their worship, I think, is a real asset. And it really brings a sense of engagement to people who maybe feel that our worship is not something they can connect to as well. And I think that is a real tremendous help spiritually.
I think the faith, you know, I think we are very, our faith is very profound. The faith of the people in general in Latin America is very, so it moves them. You know, whatever they do in life, they do it around the religion and their faith. So I think everything will be different if you just live your life around it, around your beliefs.
Beautiful, beautiful. And this, of course, is the gift of multiculturalism, that we maintain our identities, but we share, and that we grow from each other. So thank you both for joining us. We've been speaking with Sister Rachel, the pastoral associate of St. Thomas in Peoria Heights, and Veronica Barzallo about multiculturalism's impact on the Catholic Church, and in particular about the growing influence of Spanish-speaking Catholics. I'm Rabbi Daniel Bogard, and you're listening to Peoria on Faith, a production of 89.9 Peoria Public Radio.